14. Hillman had an old purple Valiant with badly rusted rocker panels. He looked up, driver's side door open, as Dugan loomed over him. "I'm coming with you tomorrow." Ev's eyes widened.
"You don't even know where I'm going."
"No. But if I'm with you, I won't have to worry that you're going to set half the woods in eastern Maine on fire, trying to send me a message like 007. Ev looked at him consideringly and then shook his head.
"I'd feel better having someone with me," he said. "Especially a guy as big as Gorilla Monsoon who packs a gun. But they ain't stupid in Haven, Officer Dugan. They never were, and I got a feeling that they're a lot less stupid just lately. They expect to see you at her funeral. If they don't, they're going to be suspicious."
"Christ, I'd like to know how the hell you can stand there babbling all that crazy shit and sound so fucking sane."
"Maybe because you know, too," Ev said. "How funny it is. How funny all of these things started in Haven."
Then, with a prescience that was startling, he added,
"Or maybe you knew Ruth well enough yourself to sense she'd gotten off kilter."
The two men stood looking at each other in the graveled parking lot of the dairy barracks, the sun beating down on them, their shadows, clear and black, slanting out neatly at 2 o'clock.
"I'll let on tonight that I'm sick," Dugan said, "but I've got stomach flu. It's been going around the barracks. What do you think?"
Ev nodded with sudden relief. That relief was so great it was startling. The idea of sneaking back into Haven had frightened him more than he had been willing to let on, especially to himself. He had half convinced this big cop that something might be going on there. He could see it in his face. Half convinced wasn't much, maybe, but it was still a giant step forward from where he had been. And of course he hadn't done it alone. Ruth McCausland had helped.
"All right," he said. "But listen to me, Trooper Dugan, and listen good, because our lives could depend on it tomorrow. Don't you call up any of the men who will be going to the funeral tomorrow and tell them the reason you're not going to be there is just a gag you're running. Call up a few people tonight and tell them you really are just as sick as a dog, that you hope you are going to be able to make it, but you doubt it."
Dugan frowned.
"Why would you want me to say?"
But suddenly he knew, and his mouth dropped open. The old man stared back at him calmly enough.
"Christ Jesus, are you telling me that you think the people in Haven are mind readers? That if my men knew I really wasn't sick, the people in town could pick the news right out of their heads?"
"I ain't telling you a thing, Trooper Dugan," Ev said. "You are telling me..."
"Mr. Hillman, I really think that you must be imagining."
"I never expected you'd want to come with me when I came to see you. I wasn't angling for it, either. The most I hoped for was that you'd keep an eye out and see my flare if I got in trouble, and that would at least keep the heat on that nest of snakes down there a while longer. But if you offer a man more, he wants more. Trust me a little further, please. For Ruth's sake. If that's what it takes to convince you to come with me, I'm willing to use it. Something else. No matter what, you're going to feel some peculiar things tomorrow."
"I've felt some pretty peculiar ones today," Dugan said.
"Ah,"
Ev said, and waited for Dugan to decide.
"Do you have some actual place to go in mind?" Dugan asked after a moment. "Or are you just going to ramble around the town until you get tired of it?"
"I've got a place in mind," Ev said quietly. He thought,
"Oh, yes. Yes, siree, Bob, up behind the old Garrick place on the outskirts of Big Engine Woods, where compasses have never worked worth a tin shit in a gold mine. And I believe we'll strike on a pretty good path through the woods to it, whatever it is, because equipment like the stuff Bobby Anderson and her friend have been using leaves a back trail as wide as a freeway. No, I don't believe there will be any trouble finding it at all."
"Okay. Give me the address of the place you're staying in, Derry, and I'll pick you up at 9 in my personal car. We'll get to Haven just about the time the service starts."
"The car's my treat," Ev said quietly.
"Not this one. It's known in Haven. I'll have a rental. And you'll want to show up at 8, because we'll be doing a bit of back roading.
I can get us into Haven and still keep clear of the village, Dugan said. You don't have to worry about that.
I ain't. But I want us to skirt the whole town and come in from the Albion side, and I think I know just the way to do it.
Why the hell does it have to be that end of town?
Because it's the furthest from where they'll be, and that's where I want to come back into Haven. As far from them as I can get.
You're really scared, aren't you?
Ev nodded.
Why a rental car?
Criminy, don't you ask a lot of questions.
And Ev rolled his eyes in such a comical way that Butch Dugan grinned.
It's my job,
he said.
Why do you want to go on a rental? No one in Haven is going to know my personal car.
He paused, thinking.
At least, not now that Ruth's dead.
Because it's my obsession,
Ev Hillman said. His face suddenly cracked into a smile of startling sweetness.
And the person ought to pay the freight on his own obsession.
All right, Butch said. I give up. 8 o'clock, your route, your car, your obsession. I must be crazy. Everything must be.
By tomorrow, at this time, I think you're going to have a much better idea of what crazy is,
Ev said, and climbed into his old purple Valiant before Dugan could ask him any more questions. Butch, in fact, had no more questions to ask. He felt glum, as if he had bought the Brooklyn Bridge his first day in New York City, shelling out even though he knew a thing that big probably couldn't be for sale.
No one gets taken who doesn't want to get taken,
he thought. He had worked Frog and Bunko out of Augusta for 3 years, and that was the first thing they taught you. The old man had been queerly persuasive, but Butch Dugan knew that he had not been persuaded into this. He had jumped. Because he had loved Ruth McCausland. And in another year or so, he probably would have plucked up sufficient nerve to propose to her. Because when someone you love dies, it leaves a black hole in the middle of your heart. And one way to plug such a hole is to refuse to admit that he or she was taken away by a stupid mischance. Better if you can believe, even for a little while, that someone or something you can get hold of was responsible. It makes the hole a little smaller. Even a rube knows that much. Sighing, suddenly feeling much older than his age, Dugan trudged back to the barracks. Ev went to the hospital and sat for most of that day's remainder with Hilly. Around 3 o'clock, he wrote 2 notes. One he put on Hilly's night table, anchored against the breeze that pawed with occasional playfulness through the open window with a little pot of flowers. The other note was longer, and when he was done with it, he folded it and put it in his pocket. Then he left the hospital. He drove to a small building in the Dairy Industrial Park, Main Med Supplies, the sign over the door read, and below that, specializing in respiration supplies and respiration therapy since 1946. He told the man inside what he wanted. The man told him it sounded as if he really ought to take a ride up to Bangor and talk to the folks that down east scuba dive. Ev explained that a scuba tank was the last thing he wanted. He was interested in as much dry land portability as he could get. He and the fellow talked a while longer, and Ev left, after signing a 36-hour rental agreement with a rather specialized piece of equipment. The fellow at Main Med Supplies stood at the door watching him go, scratching his head. 15. The nurse read the note by Hilly's bed.
Hilly, I may not see you for a while now, but I just wanted to tell you I think you'll get over this bad patch, and if I can help you do it, I guess I will be just about the happiest grandpa in the world. I believe David is still alive, and I don't think it's your fault that he got lost in the first place. I love you, Hilly, and I hope to see you soon. Gramp. But he never saw Hilly Brown again.
Chapter 9. The Funeral. 1. From 9 o'clock on, out-of-towners who had known or worked with Ruth McCausland began to come into Haven Village. Soon, almost every parking space along Main Street was taken.
The Haven Lunch did a brisk business. Beach kept busy short-ordering eggs, bacon, sausages, and home fries. He brewed pot after pot of coffee. Representative Brennan hadn't come, but he had sent a close aide.
Should have come yourself, Joe,
Beach thought with a little sunken smile.
Might have got a whole slew of new ideas about how to run the government.
The day dawned brisk and clear, more like late September than late July. The sky was bright blue. The temperature a moderate 68 degrees, the wind out of the west at about 20 miles an hour. Once more, there were outsiders in Haven. And once more, Haven had gotten lucky weather for them. And soon it wouldn't matter whether they were lucky or not, the townsfolk told each other without speaking. Soon they would be in charge of their own luck. A good day, you would have said. The best kind of New England summer's day, the sort the tourists come for. A day to prick the appetite fully alive. Those who came to Haven from out of town ordered hearty breakfasts, as people with lively appetites are apt to do, but Beach noted that most of those breakfasts came back only half-eaten. The newcomers lost their appetites quickly. The light went out of their eyes, and they began to look, for the most part, shallow and a little sick. The lunch was crowded, but conversation lagged.
Must be that the air here in our little town don't quite agree with you folks,
Beach thought. He imagined going into the storeroom, where the device he had used to get rid of the two nosy cops was hidden under a pile of tablecloth. He imagined bringing it out here, a great big deadly bazooka, and just washing his lunchroom clean of all these outsiders with a purifying blast of green fire. No. Not now, not yet. Soon it wouldn't matter, next month. But for now? He looked down at the plate he was scraping and saw a tooth in someone's scrambled eggs.
Tommy knockers come in, my friends,
Beach thought.
Only when they finally get here, I don't think they'll even bother knocking. I think they'll just blow the fucking door right down.
Beach's grin widened. He scraped the tooth off the plate with the rest of the garbage. 2. Dugan could be silent when he wanted, and this morning that was what he wanted. Apparently it was what the old man wanted, too. Dugan had gotten to Ev Hillman's apartment building on Lower Main promptly at 8, and had found a Jeep Cherokee standing at the curb behind the old party's Valiant. There was a big gunny sack in the back, its top tied with hay rope.
Did you rent this in Bangor?
Leased it at Derry AMC, Ev said.
Must have been expensive.
'Twasn't too dear. That ended the conversation. They arrived somewhere near the Albion Haven town line 1 hour and 40 minutes later. We'll be doing a bit of back roading, the old man had said, and if that wasn't a classic understatement, Butch didn't know what was. He had been driving in this part of Maine for almost 20 years, and before today had thought he knew it like the back of his hand. Now he knew better. Hillman knew it like the back of his hand, by comparison. Butch Dugan had a general working knowledge of the area, no more. They went from the turnpike to Route 69, from 69 to two-lane blacktop, then to gravel in western Troy, then to hardpan, then to rutted dirt, with grass growing up the middle, finally to an overgrown logging track that looked as if it might have last been seriously used around 1950.
"Do you know where the fuck you're going?"
Butch shouted as the Cherokee crashed through rotted corduroy, then hauled itself out, engine howling, all four wheels spinning up mud and chewed splinters. Ev only nodded. He clung to the Cherokee's big wheel like an old balding monkey. One woods road led into another, and finally they crashed out of a scree of foliage and onto a dirt road Butch recognized as Albion Town Road No. 5. Butch had thought it impossible, but the old man had done exactly what he promised, brought them all the way around Haven, without ever once going in. Now, Ev brought the Cherokee to a stop, just 100 feet short of the marker announcing the Haven town line. He turned off the engine and unrolled his window. There was no sound but the tick of the engine. There was no birdsong. And Butch thought this odd.
"What's in that gunny sack back there?"
Butch asked.
All kinds of things. No need to worry about it now.
What are you waiting for?
Church bells,
Ev said.
3. It was not the Methodist church bells that Ev had grown up with and expected, which rang out at 9:45, calling Ruth's mourners, both the real ones and those prepared to shed copious floods of crocodile tears, to the Methodist church. For the first act of the 3-act festivities was to be played out, Act 2, graveside ceremonies, Act 3, refreshments in the town library. Reverend Gueringer, a shy man who usually had not the fortitude to say boo to a goose, had gone around town a few weeks ago telling people he was getting damn tired of all that gonging.
"Then why don't you do something about it, Gooey?" Pamela Sargent asked him.
Reverend Lester Gueringer had never been called Gooey in his entire life, but in his current state of rancor he barely noticed.
"Maybe I will,"
he said, looking at her through his thick glasses grimly.
"Just maybe I will."
"Got any ideas?"
"I might,"
he said slyly.
"Time'll tell, won't it?"
"It always does, Gooey," she said. "Always does."
The Reverend Gueringer, in fact, had a fine idea about those bells. He could hardly believe it had never occurred to him before. It was so simple and beautiful. And the best thing about it was that he wouldn't have to take it up with the deacons or with the Ladies' Aid, an organization which apparently attracted only 2 types of women, fat slobs with boobs the size of barrels, and skinny-ass, flat-chested sluts like Pamela Sargent with her fake ivory cigarette holder and her raspy smoker's cough. Or with the few well-to-do members of his congregation. Going to them always gave him a week's worth of acid indigestion. He did not like to beg. No, this was something the Reverend Lester Gueringer could do all by himself, and so he did it. Fuck 'em all if they couldn't take a joke.
"And if you ever call me Gooey again, Pam," he had whispered as he rewired the fuse box in the church basement so it could handle the heavy voltage his idea would require, "I'll jam the plumber's friend in the parsonage pissoir up your twat and plunge out your brains if you haven't pissed 'em all away."
He cackled and went on rewiring. Reverend Lester Gueringer had never had such blunt thoughts or said such blunt things in his life, and he found the experience liberating and exhilarating. He was, in fact, prepared to tell anyone in Haven who didn't like his new carillon that they could take a flying puck at a rolling donut. But everyone in town had thought the change nothing short of magnificent. It was, too. And today the Reverend Gueringer felt a real heart-swell of pride as he flicked the new switch in the vestry, and the sound of the bells floated out over Haven, playing a medley of hymns. The carillon was programmable, and today Lester Gueringer plugged in the hymns which had been particular favorites of Ruth's. They included such old Methodist and Baptist standbys as "What a Friend We Have in Jesus," and "This Is My Father's World." The Reverend Gueringer stood back, rubbing his hands together, and watched as people began to move toward the church in groups and 2s and 3s, drawn by the bells, the calling of the bells.
"Hot damn!"
the Reverend Gueringer exclaimed. He had never felt better in his life, and he meant to send Ruth McCausland off in style. He intended to preach 1 pie-cutter of a eulogy. After all, they had all loved her. 4. The bells. Dave Rutledge, Haven's oldest citizen, tipped an ear toward them and smiled toothlessly. Even if the bells had jangled discordantly, he would have smiled because he could hear them. Until early July, Dave had been almost completely deaf, and his lower limbs were always cold as his circulation steadily failed. He was, after all, 90, and that made him an old dog. But this month, his hearing and circulation had magically improved. People told him he looked 10 years younger, and by Christ, he felt 20 years younger. And my, wasn't the sound of those bells playing just the sweetest thing? Dave got up and started toward the church. 5. The calling of the bells. In January, the aide U.S. Representative Brennan had sent to Haven had been in D.C., and there he had met a beautiful young woman named Annabelle. This summer she had come to Maine to be with him, and had come to Haven with him this morning to keep him company. He had promised her they would overnight in Bar Harbor before going back to Augusta. At first she thought it had been a bad idea, because she began to feel a little nauseated in the restaurant and hadn't been able to finish her breakfast. For one thing, the short order cook looked like an older, fatter version of Charles Manson. He kept smiling the strangest little smile when he thought no one was looking. It was enough to make you wonder if he had powdered the scrambled eggs with arsenic. But the sound of the bells chiming hymns she hadn't heard since her Nebraska childhood charmed her with wonder. My God, Marty, how can a little wide place in the road town like this afford a gorgeous carillon like that?
Maybe some rich summer tourist died and left it to them,
Marty said vaguely. He had no interest in the carillon. He'd had a headache ever since they got here and was getting worse. Also, one of his gums was bleeding. Pyorrhea ran in his family. He hoped to God it wasn't that.
Come on, let's go over to the church.
So we can get it done and go up to Bar Harbor and screw our brains out,
he thought.
This is one creepy little town.
They started across the street together, she in a black suit. But, she had told him archly on their way up, her underwear was all white silk. What little of it there was. He in a governmental charcoal gray. The people of Haven, dressed in their soberest finery, walked with them. Marty saw a surprising number of powder blue state police uniforms. Look, Marty. The clock. She was pointing at the tower of the town hall. It was a good solid red brick, but for a moment it seemed to swim and waver before Marty's eyes. His headache was instantly worse. Maybe it was eye strain. He'd had a checkup 3 months ago, and the guy had said his vision was good enough to fly a jet, but maybe he'd been wrong. Half the professional people in America were on coke these days. He had read all about it in Time, and why was his mind wandering like this anyway? It was the bells. They seemed to be echoing and multiplying in his head. 10, 100, 1,000, 1,000,000 all playing when we meet at Jesus' feet.
What about the clock?
He asked irritably. The hands are funny, she said. They look almost drawn on. 6. The calling of the bells. Eddie Stampnell of the Dairy Barracks crossed the street with Andy Rideout from Orono. Both of them had known Ruth, liked her.
Pretty, ain't it?
Eddie asked dubiously.
Maybe, Andy said. I just keep thinking of Bant and Jingles getting blown away by a couple of numbnut rubes out here, probably buried in some farmer's potato field, and it just sounds like a bone phone to me. Seems like Haven's bad luck now. I know that's stupid, but that's how I feel.
It's bad luck for my head, Eddie replied. It aches like a bastard.
Well, let's get it over and get out, Andy said. She was a good woman, but she's gone. And between you and me, I don't care if I never spend another 15 minutes in Haven now that she is.
They stepped into the Methodist church together, neither of them looking at Reverend Lester Gooringer, who stood beside the switch which controlled his lovely carillon, smiling and rubbing his dry hands together and accepting the compliments of all and sundry. 7. The crying of the bells. Bobby Anderson got out of her blue Chevrolet truck, slamming the door, smoothing her dark blue dress over her hips, and checking her makeup in the truck's outside mirror before walking slowly down the sidewalk to the church. She walked with her head down and her shoulders slumped. She was trying hard to get the rest she needed to go on, and Guard had helped to put a brake on her obsession.
And that's what it is, an obsession. No use kidding yourself.
But Guard was a brake that was slowly wearing out. He wasn't at the funeral because he was sleeping off a monumental drunk, his grizzled, worn face pillowed on one arm, his breath a sour cloud around him. Anderson was tired, all right, but it was more than just that. A great, unfocused grief seemed to fill her this morning. It was partly for Ruth, partly for David Brown, partly for the whole town. Yet mostly, she suspected, it was for herself. The becoming continued, for everyone in Haven except Guard, that was. And it was good. But she mourned her own unique identity, which was now fading like a morning mist. She knew now that The Buffalo Soldiers was her last book, and the irony was that she now suspected the Tommyknockers had written most of that as well. 8. The bells, bells, bells. Haven answered them. It was Act One of a charade titled The Burial of Ruth McCausland, or How We Love That Woman. Nancy Voss had closed the post office to come. The government would not have approved, but what the government didn't know wouldn't hurt them. They would know plenty soon enough, she thought. They would get a big old express mail delivery from Haven very soon, them and every other government on this flying mudball. Frank Spruce, Haven's biggest dairy farmer, answered the bells. John Mumphrey, whose father had run against Ruth for the position of town constable, answered them. Ashley Raval, who had passed her out by the town line 2 days before her death, answered them with his parents. Ashley was crying. Doc Warwick was there, and Judd Tarkington. Adley McKean came with Hazel McCready on his arm. Newt Beringer and Dick Allison answered them, walking slowly and supporting Ruth's predecessor, John Harley, between them. John was feeble and nearly transparent. Maggie, his wife, was not well enough to attend. They came, answering the summons of the bells, Tremaines and Thurlows, Applegates and Goldmans, Duplisseys and Archenvorgs. Good main people, you would have said, drawn from a healthy stockpot that was mostly French, Irish, Scots, and Canadian. But they were different now. As they drew together at the church, so did their minds draw together and become one mind, watching the outsiders, listening for the slightest wrong note in their thoughts. They came together, they listened, and the bells rang in their strange blood. 9. Ev Hillman sat up behind the wheel of the Cherokee, eyes opening wide at the dim sound of the carillon.
What in the hell?
Church bell. What else?
Butch Dugan said.
It sounds very pretty. They're getting ready to start the funeral, I suppose.
They're burying Ruth over in the village. What in God's name am I doing out here by the town line with this crazy old man?
He wasn't sure, but it was too late to change his course now.
The bells in the Methodist church never made a sound like that before in my time, Ev said. Someone's changed them over.
So what?
So nothing. So everything. I don't know. Come on, Trooper Dugan.
He turned the key and the Cherokee's engine roared.
I'll ask you again,
Dugan said with what he thought was extraordinary patience.
What are we looking for?
I don't rightly know.
The Cherokee passed the town line marker. They had left Albion now and entered Haven. Ev had a sudden sickening premonition that in spite of all his precautions and care, he was never going to leave it again.
We'll know it when we see it.
Dugan didn't reply, only held on for dear life and wondered again how he had gotten into this. He had to be as crazy as the old fart he was riding with, and then some. He raised one hand to his forehead and began rubbing just above the eyebrows. A headache was forming there. 10. There were sniffles, red eyes, and some sobbing as the Reverend Gouringer, his bald head gleaming mellowly and in a soft variety of colors, courtesy of the summer sunshine falling through the stained glass windows, launched into his funeral eulogy following a hymn, a prayer, another hymn, a reading of Ruth's favorite scripture, the Beatitudes, and yet another hymn. Below him, foaming around the lectern in a semicircle, were great bunches of summer flowers. Even with the upper windows of the church thrown open and a good breeze blowing through, their smell was suffocatingly sweet.
We have come here to praise Ruth McCausland and to celebrate her passing, Gouringer began.
The townsfolk sat with hands either folded or gripping handkerchiefs. Their eyes, most wet, regarded Gouringer with sober, studious attention. They looked healthy, these folk. Their color was good, their skin, for the most part, unblemished. And even someone who had never been in Haven before could have seen that the congregation here fell naturally into two groups. The outsiders didn't look healthy. They were pale. Their eyes were dazed. Twice during the eulogy, people left hurriedly, dashed around the corner of the church, and were quietly sick. For others, the nausea was a lower complaint, an uneasy rolling in the bowels, not quite serious enough to cause an exit, but simply going on and on. End of side 10. To continue, change side selector switch
and turn the cassette over.